You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 26th of March. And on the show today, we focused on a cybercrime topic because scamming soars during the holy month. And I'm delighted to say we were joined by someone right at the forefront of the fight against cybercrime, the director of that department for Dubai Police. Brigadier Saeed Al-Hadri took our questions on the most common scams and told us how to avoid getting caught out both this Ramadan and at any time. We also did our regular roundup of all the scams that people have been experiencing recently. It's a must listen if you want to avoid getting caught out. Plus, we continued our Ramadan theme on charitable giving in the holy month. We caught up with expat Kelly Harvard from Dubai Goodwill. She told us how she is feeding workers this Ramadan with the help of dozens of volunteers. And Islamic philanthropy expert Tofiq Rahim talked charitable trends and how wealthy people in the Middle East are giving. Meanwhile, a massive solar flare has hit Earth over the last few hours. We found out whether we need to worry, and we caught up with a doctor from Aster Clinic who's responsible for changing a young man's life. That's after his face was left unrecognisable after a motorbike accident.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to the programme. So many stories of scams are coming through, and Dubai Police are warning the public to be on the lookout for cybercrime, but also on the lookout for professional street beggars as well. They say that people are coming into the UAE deliberately on a visit visa with the specific aim of taking advantage of UAE residents during this holy month. And they say they've already arrested one woman who was exploiting her baby son and collected 30,000 dirhams from members of the public. And they say that this street crime seems to be getting worse. Last year, they arrested nearly 500 people, and that was up from 318 in 2022. But for the next few minutes, we're actually not going to focus on street begging. Instead, we're going to talk about cybercrime, which really soars during Ramadan as more people are either looking online to give money or maybe looking online for deals and discounts. And the scammers are getting more and more sophisticated. In fact, producer Jen was targeted a couple of weeks ago. She received a fraudulent call from someone on number from Liechtenstein. It's in somewhere in Europe, pretending to be from Dubai Police. They then managed to generate an OTP that actually looked like it came through on a real Dubai Police number. The use of that OTP and the Dubai Police number made the fraud look really genuine. And it sort of struck Jen as a new approach from those who pretended to be the police. Now, this led us to get in touch with the team from Dubai Police. And I'm delighted to say that earlier on the programme, we were joined by Brigadier Saeed Al-Hadri. He is director of the cybercrime department for Dubai Police. And he talked us through, you know, the regularity of these types of scams.
Scams is evolving. Day by day, we see new methods and different modus operandi. And this is called the evolve from the social engineering perspective, because we put security measures for all the services online. And these services are open widely to the public. And scammers, now they get to know the methodologies and they try to scam people over their personal and private data. And because there is rise on scam worldwide, not only in Dubai, those scammers are targeting any victim that have any online services, including Dubai Police or others. However, we identify those scammers are resident. They get operated offshore of the borders of Dubai as a region or the UAE. And we work closely with our partners of the law enforcement in their region. However, they try to locate themselves in areas that is not security stabilized. That's why there is a huge rise on scam centers on these regions where there's a huge conflict. People try to survive their lives or they have a lot of corruption in their region. That's why there is rise on this scams and all over the world.
Yeah, you can see that people take advantage of, I suppose, loopholes in the law or loopholes in the security of a country in order to base themselves there. And then thanks to the globalized nature of the internet, they can target anyone anywhere in the world. I know that one of the ways that the scammers are managing to target people is because they use the name of Dubai Police. And as a consequence, you know, you then start to trust them or you worry that you're about to get into trouble, for example. Under what circumstances, if any, would Dubai Police actually call a member of the public? Can you see that ever happening?
Dubai Police will have a very high standard in terms of privacy and security. And it is crucial to understand that officers will never ask sensitive and personal data. They will not ask about bank account information or credit card number or ID or even OTP over the phone. The OTP is meant to be inserted into a system. They may contact you only if you are a victim or a witness or try to contact you about any basic matters, and they will give you a reference number of the case that you complain about or these means. Otherwise, they will not call you out of the blue and try to get personal private data from the public.
How can you tell if that call is genuine? Is there a way of seeing, for example, what number it comes through on? Like, for example, I'm deeply suspicious if anyone ever rings me on a mobile phone number. I'm a bit like, you're not from Dubai Police. Dubai Police aren't going to call me on a mobile.
Look, the call itself, the communication used by Dubai Police officer is official. If you're receiving a corresponding complaint from, if you complain about a case or you reported a crime or you reported a ticket or fines or anything, you might get a call or based also with the victim support. You can tell from the number because it shows in the display that this number came from Dubai Police. You can also verify if you get local numbers that start from 04, because this is the open code from Dubai Police, you can call back on the organization which the officers call you from. Always the callback verify the caller ID. And this is the way you can tell it, this number is genuine. Also, they will give you some details about the case. They will give you a case number, the date, when did you report. So they will give you some insights of details of your reports.
If you are getting scam calls or text messages, and I think nearly all of us have got them at various times, there was a post office scam going round. There's an Aramex scam going round. I like to create a kind of library of scams. And then if we all warn each other, then we're less likely to sort of fall for it. But if you are targeted, what's the best way to report it to Dubai Police?
You can report it through the Dubai Police channels. It's we have a special app for reporting. It's the only one which accumulate all the services, including the e-crime, police eye, and we have also 901 for non-emergency. If it's emergency, you can call 999. But the best way is to report it as soon as it happened, because those phishing websites, they disable it after a while. After they take the data and the information, they try to shut it down or create another mirror of this fraud. And this also grow as these media campaigns increase with the utilization of the artificial intelligence now is happening, and they can mitigate the pictures, the voice. So people need to be careful about their data, and they're responsible to keep their private data as secure as possible.
As the director of the cybercrime department for Dubai Police, does it feel like a bit like a cat and mouse game? You know, you're constantly trying to catch up with the criminals as they evolve their style.
Yes, that's our job, actually. And we're working hard to catch those criminals and take the means and ways to prevent them from happening. The problem is it is rising because the cross borders issue with the communication across the nations where they have problems and issues. Plus, the people who are seeking jobs in these times, they are trying to find the jobs, and these scammers try to hire them to commit more scams. They don't understand until it's too late. So whether if you get a job to become a scammer or you came across scammers, please report it to the e-crime services in Dubai Police app. And this, I think it will keep evolving until we find a way to collaborate together. Society, government, law enforcement, everyone is responsible to take down these scammers.
Fantastic to have Brigadier Saeed Al-Hajri on the radio. Really good of him to spend so much time with us here on The Agenda. He is the director of the Cybercrime Department for Dubai Police.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to the show. We're talking scams on the programme today. Apparently, they go up a huge amount during Ramadan. The team from the Business Breakfast actually spoke to Amir Kolazadeh from ITSEC. I think that probably stands for IT security. And he actually explained to them why there is such a surge of cyber crimes during the holy month.
In Ramadan, being a month of forgiveness, a month of charity, everybody's guards are much more down, right? And everybody's in a more relaxed mode. So the psychology of cyber criminals obviously are past the keystroke just to hack you. Now they're hacking the psyche of the society. We call it social engineering. When you combine a social engineering and an actual cyber attack, that's what you get, a 45% rise in a cyber attack in a special month.
So is the UAE a particular target for cyber criminals?
If you look at the GCC, UAE is always number one in attacks. Obviously, the concentration of the wealth and the wealthy that we have, obviously being in the news as always, to people who has never been to UAE, all they see is glitz, right? The tall buildings, the Ferraris and Lamborghinis. So that automatically makes us a higher target than anywhere else in the world.
So that is yet another reason why people here in the country need to be particularly careful. So many messages coming in from people who have nearly been a victim of scams. Please do keep them coming, 4001, or you can WhatsApp me on 04 871 5500. Riaz joins me on the line now. You got in touch with us, Riaz, because you were actually recently scammed, weren't you?
Hi, Georgia. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for joining me on the radio. Lovely to hear from you.
No, thank you for bringing this issue up. You know, it's such an important issue. So recently, I think a week back, I was passing by the Dubai Museum. The Museum of the Eye, the Museum of the Future. Sorry, and I realized that why don't I book some tickets for my sister who's visiting from Canada? So I quickly went on my phone and basically Google, Museum of the Future. And a website popped out and it looked like legitimate. I went and selected the dates. I was a bit surprised because I said, normally they're booked, right? You need to book in advance. But I was,
yes.
I said to myself, I'm lucky. Maybe it's Ramadan, the availabilities are there. So then I did, and the whole website looked legitimate. The names, the Dubai Museum, and it was also ranked number one on the Google search. And I went there and basically booked the date, the time, and the number of tickets. It came to 900 dirhams. I said, yeah, that's legitimate, 900 dirhams. Then I entered my credit card details, and it prompted for an OTP number. When I got the message from my bank, it didn't say 900 dirhams. It just had a letter AMD followed by 4,500, And I was thinking like, okay, normally dirhams come, but okay, it's not a yen. It's not, nothing like of those known currencies popped in my mind, And then I entered the OTP and immediately I saw that I was deducted like in 37,000 dirhams, So
37,
you can imagine.
37,000 dirhams. Oh,
37,892 dirhams. So I immediately called my bank and I put a block on the card and I said, look, I'm filing a claim. But they said that you authorized it. I said, yes, I did authorize it. But thinking that, you know, that it was 900 dirhams, I didn't see the 900 dirhams. You know, it just had this East European, basically, currency that would no one would recognize it, right?
No one would. Do you know, Riaz, I'm so sorry to hear that this has happened to you. The exact same experience happened to my husband about, well, not the exact same, but it happened about 5 years ago. And he was paying it for him. It was the Emirates Post. He thought there was some tax to pay, VAT or import tax to pay. It was like 8 or 9 dirhams. And he ended up, it was nearly exactly the same number. And it was in Guatemala. Somebody was in Guatemala and it ended up coming through that he'd bought a motorbike in Guatemala. And he's never managed to get the money back from the bank. And it was such, it really hurt. It still hurts, doesn't it? It does.
It's devastated, let's put it this way.
No, it is. It's a devastating amount of money. It's a life-changing amount of money. And have you been able to get it back? Have you? Because the banks were really harsh on us. There was no suggestion.
No, the bank called me back a few days back. They said, look, because I exactly sent them the real website. And the funny thing is, even the website as I speak right now, it's still on.
It's still there. Oh, my
gosh. Yeah, it's still out there. And in the official website, I only found out going through their Instagram account. So you can imagine, like, you know, this is. And I also wrote to the Museum of the Future. Look, there's someone emulating your website out there and it's ranked, you know, but I never heard back from them. So I said to myself, fair enough. But what I was shocked the most is that how can it be ranked, you know, and I found out that these scammers pay Google, apparently, to be ranked up there.
That's how they get up there. They literally pay the money. But then if they're making, you know, 37,000 dirhams when they manage to rip people off, they can afford it. You're not the... So just so you know, Riaz, one of the major feelings that my husband had was a feeling of real sort of shame. It really got to him for years, ages. But you must... And I know other people who've been done in by this exact scam as well. You mustn't feel that way because... They're professional criminals. They do everything. This is their job. They do everything they can to steal people's money. And unfortunately, they sometimes succeed because we live busy lives. We have to crack on with stuff, right? You can't.
I've been here for 28 years. I've seen scam, you know, throughout, you know.
Yeah.
But at this scale, it's phenomenal. I mean, I was like, you know, I normally never put my guards down, you know.
No, me either.
I was maybe consumed with the fact that I became emotional. My sister is coming, you know, I want them to visit this place.
Yeah.
But I said, if it's too good to be true, don't trust anything.
Do you know, Riaz, you're amazing that you can have this conversation without sounding, without sort of the sort of bitter recriminations. And it's been it's amazing to have you join us on the line. Thank you very much indeed. And certainly, Riaz, at least by speaking on the radio now, you will have managed to at least put, you know, hopefully thousands of people off a ticket, you know, clicking on that particular website. For what it's worth, we've had several other people, professional people, get in touch, just like Riaz, explaining the various sort of attacks that they've had recently. One of my friends actually got in touch yesterday to say, that whatever he's been directly targeted again by someone who was pretending to be from Dubai police. They had apparently tons of information already, including passport numbers. They were able to email this person from official government addresses and they were trying to get his bank account details. It was incredibly sophisticated. And this person, even though he works in the security sector, like he's naturally very alert to these types of things, he was nearly taken in. He basically had to get in the car and drive to a police station before they hung up. They tried everything to keep him on the line. And then he called Dubai police to check and he was told that the number that they were calling from was a scam. But it was a very, very narrow escape. And I imagine that he was driving to the police station at the time while talking to them because he was still so suspicious, but he nearly fell for it. So... honestly, they're getting so sophisticated now. It's very difficult to know whether anything you're hearing is true. A sad message has come through here from Mifadil, who says, 7 years ago, I fell victim to a scam that cost me 3,700 dirhams. It was during the month of Ramadan. I received a call from a hacker claiming that I'd won 200,000 dirhams from a special campaign by Do Telecom, where my SIM number series matched the jackpot. Now, I was initially sceptical, but the hacker provided me with the full series number, which matched my SIM card, and that led me to believe the claim. And that is the point at which I became a victim. Now, they told me to open a bank account in Oman, transfer funds totaling 3,700 dirhams, and they promised that I would then receive my winnings of 200,000 dirhams afterwards. However, the promised payout never materialized, and that is when I realized it was all a fraud. I demanded a refund, the scammer refused, and desperate for recourse, I reported the fraud to the police, hoping that they could apprehend the criminal by tracing the phone number. Unfortunately, at that point, I was told that transferring the funds was my error. Now, I have to say that that does seem to be, unfortunately, the reality in many of these situations. Certainly, these frauds, these scams are not victimless crimes. I think quite a lot of the scammers maybe tell themselves that, you know, you can just claim on the insurance. But we've seen time and time again that unfortunately that really isn't the case. The banks do not pay you back your money. They do not then use their insurance to pay themselves back. And sadly, there are increasing numbers of scams doing the rounds. Kiki just got in touch saying, I was actually involved in a scam over the weekend. I was looking for a kitten and I came across a Facebook group. There were loads of posts on the group and it looked real. And I contacted the admin for the adoption of a kitten. Apparently, you know, what they involved was, you know, paying for, that would involve paying for vaccinations, accessories and transport for Abu Dhabi, they said. And then after paying 500 dirhams, the delivery of the kitten was meant to be the next day. Then I received another message from another person saying they were the Emirates Courier Express and they needed 3,330 dirhams for insurance for delivery. I contacted the seller and said, well, they didn't inform me of this and said, this is a scam. And then, of course, they kept the 500 dirhams. These people were using local numbers for WhatsApp. So please beware, you know, be nervous, be aware.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Lovely to have you with us. And on the programme today, we're going to be taking a look at one of the key features of the holy month of Ramadan. It is, of course, charitable giving or zakat. For those of you who don't know, maybe you've moved to the country recently, that is the donation that Muslims give to eligible beneficiaries such as the poor, debtors and stranded travellers. And on the show today, we're going to get both a sort of big picture on Islamic philanthropy and also a grassroots viewpoint. And I'm delighted to say we're going to look at the sort of grassroots element first. And I'm joined on the line now by Kelly Harvard, who is one of the organisers behind Dubai Goodwill. She's joined me on Microsoft Teams. Kelly, how are you? Lovely to speak to you in person. I follow you on Instagram, so I feel like I know you because I see so much of your work. Thanks so much for joining us on The Agenda this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, Georgia. It's such a pleasure to be able to talk to you during Ramadan, which is such a special month for so many people and for all of us. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to tell you more about what we're doing.
Yeah, what is it that you do with Dubai Goodwill? What is the aim and the purpose of the organisation?
Yeah, so great question to start with. So Dubai Goodwill, I mean, the seed of it actually started many years ago with the Ramadan fridges. I'm sure that some of your longer time listeners and Dubai residents will remember these fridges. I cannot take credit for that idea, I have to point out. It's a beautiful idea where you took a fridge, you popped outside your house or your office during Ramadan. You fill it with food, you fill it with drink. And the idea is that anyone that's passing can take from it, you know, perhaps if they're on their way to iftar or if they're just, you know, passing through during a busy day. And our fridge outside our villa, I'd always wanted to do it. As soon as we moved to a villa where I could put a fridge, I said to my husband, please, 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 can we do it? And we made a plan. And our fridge very quickly became super busy. We're in Jumeirah One. There's a lot of foot traffic. There's a lot of bike traffic, a lot of people coming through. And we realized that we couldn't do it on our own. You know, we were trying to stock this fridge up, just the two of us as a family, and it was really becoming just completely overwhelming, and we couldn't get enough food for people. So we decided to go out to our community. We went very old school. We knocked on doors, we distributed flyers. Of course, we used social media, but we actually knocked on people's doors and introduced ourselves and said, you know, we're Kelly and Alex, we're from this villa, we're doing this great thing. We really want to give back to the community. Will you help us? And what happened was just truly amazing. The community came together. We started being able to feed about 1,000, sometimes as many as 1,200 people a night from outside our villa. We gave out food packs to everybody. And it was just a really beautiful example of how the community can come together. And it's just, I think this is really unique to Dubai, from what I see. And it really was such an uplifting experience. And we did this for many years. And then COVID came. Yes. And of course, the fridges stopped. Yeah. So
it was so sad that, because you understand why the authorities stopped them. Because, of course, you know, there were issues with, you know, potential issues with hygiene and the spread of germs. But it was so, you know, it was so sad that they had to stop.
It was such a shame. I mean, if anybody is listening in a high place who wants to think about reestablishing them next year, I mean, please, we're all ears. So, we did stop. And quite rightly, of course, we totally respect that decision and understand why it was made. But then it left a huge gaping hole in our lives. You know, Ramadan comes and, you know, it's such a beautiful month. I feel so incredibly privileged to live in a Muslim country during Ramadan, despite not being Muslim myself. This is my 17th Ramadan. And we had these big gaps where, you know, we couldn't do anything. So that sort of seed of the Ramadan fridges in the community evolved. You know, we came together again as friends and neighbours. And we thought, you know, what else can we do? And then this then evolved into Dubai Goodwill. And Dubai Goodwill kind of has that same essence of, you know, we want to give back. We want to say thank you to the community. And that's how it's evolved. We've partnered with a local mosque, which is in Satwa, which is kind of, you know, close to where our original fridge was. They're slightly just evolved. And now we feed the community. We give out around 1,500 meals every night. And the purpose is really, I mean, yes, of course, it's to give a meal, which is a really beautiful thing. You know, people are breaking their fast. But also, the main reason, and we say this to everybody when they come, when we brief them, is, you know, please connect with people. You know, we, in my opinion, we live in the greatest city in the world. And the reason it's the greatest city in the world, apart from things like our fantastic leadership and the infrastructure, is the people that build this city and the people that care for this city. And these are the people that we're giving back to. And this is our chance to say to them, thank you, we see you, and we appreciate you so much.
And what is it like? What is the atmosphere like around iftar time when you're bringing those two, you know, I suppose previously quite different communities together? Are relationships formed?
They really are. And I'm so glad you asked that, because that is part of the beautiful thing of it. There's a couple of really wonderful things that happen. So, you know, we actually ask people, they come and they get quite involved. So the first thing we have to do is we have to bring in all the food. We give one hot meal. We give one pack, which has dates and water and fruit. So there's quite a bit of heavy lifting. You know, we're asking people to come and we really want them to get involved. They bring in all the food. It's a big job. Then we set the food up. And then we give. And what we've found is that this is our third year now with this mosque. You know, we've really got to know the people that come to take a meal. We've got to know the people that work in the mosque, the volunteers. Many people are coming back year after year. They're bringing their kids. They're bringing their families. We're seeing their families grow. And I can't really explain to you. I can only say the energy in the mosque at that time. We come at around 4 o'clock to start setting up. Which is just when the Asr prayer is happening. So we get to see the prayer. We're really lucky to see that. I feel it's a real privilege to be in the mosque and to see that prayer happening. And then we bring the food in. And, you know, we're asking a group of strangers essentially to come together. There might be 20, 25 people coming together. It's a very busy environment. We have to physically, like I say, bring the food in. We have to get set up. There's quite a lot of logistical stuff that needs to happen before we get to the point where we even give a meal. And yet people just come together. They work together. There's almost like a telepathic way that people come, they help. There's no egos. You know, we have everyone from, you know, CEOs coming to help to, you know, kids coming to help. Like, it doesn't matter who you are before you walk into that mosque. We all come in together and we all work together as a team. And there's a moment in the middle of the giving. I always say to people, you know, aside from the connecting, if you can, just take a couple of breaths in the middle of the giving, because it goes quite fast. But there is an amazing energy, and there's, I can only put it down to the fact that we're all coming together for a purpose that is higher than ourselves. And it really, I mean, it's always given me goosebumps when I talk about it now.
Well, me
because
too,
oddly
enough.
Seriously, Georgia, to be in that space when everyone is working together, it's a really powerful, beautiful thing. And that is what Ramadan is all about, in my opinion. It's bringing people together, you know, saying thank you. It almost transcends religion for us. You know, it's about how do we come together and harness this beautiful energy to say thank you and to give back.
And is there any criteria for the people who are coming to receive meals? You know, can anyone come, or is it sort of decided by the mosque? How does that work?
It's a community mosque that really sort of serves the local people that live in the area. So we welcome everybody to come in. It's quite a heavy male area, so we have lots of gentlemen who come in from all sorts of jobs and all sorts of walks of life. We also have a separate area just for ladies and families as well. So lots of ladies might come with their kids or might come with a friend who want to pick up a meal on their way home from work, or you know, just to get something ready for iftar. So no, I mean, we're very, very open. Anyone who wants to come is welcome.
And then the big question, because I think there's an awful lot of people for whom this is a sort of a passing thought, or even quite an intentional thought. And then, you know, they want to give back to the community, but then they sort of fall at the hurdle of the regulatory necessities. How have you managed to structure that? How have you made sure that your giving is legal?
Yeah, so it's a very good point. And of course, everybody wants to make sure they do something that is legal and is within the right parameters. So we are fully licensed, and the mosque very kindly works with us to get that license each year. So it's our third year, and we are, we're fully legal and licensed through all the right authorities. So we're very thankful to them for helping us with that and to make sure that people can come and they don't need to worry about that. They can come with their open hearts, and it's not something they need to be concerned about.
And if people want to join in, if they want to help you, can they do it?
Of course, absolutely. You know, we want people to come. We really want people to come and experience the beauty of giving back to the community and saying thank you to people. They can either contact us through our Instagram, which is Dubai Goodwill. You can come directly to me, which is Kelly Harvard, and we'll get you on the schedule. We have a schedule where we book people in. It's all very organized. You know, after 3 years, we have it down to quite a fine art in terms of organization. So people can get in touch and we'll get them onto the schedule. And, you know, we really encourage people to come to give. And also one thing we really want people to think about is, okay, let's not just keep the giving spirit just for Ramadan, but how can we keep that all year round, and how can we keep giving back to our community? So we're discussing at the moment what else can we do throughout the year to kind of keep this going. And also, you know, let's all keep it going in our individual life. You know, if you're going to the supermarket and there's the gentleman outside washing the cars, buy them a bag of cold drinks, you know, get them some snacks for their lunch or their break. You know, there's small ways that we can give all the time. Give your smile, give your conversation, you know, give with an open heart to everybody around you, because that's the spirit of Ramadan, and we really think it can go all through the year as well.
Kelly Harvard, an absolute pleasure to have you join us on the line. Thank you very much indeed. If you want to find out about more about Dubai Goodwill, I would recommend going to their Instagram page. It's super easy to find.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to the show. Talking about giving this Ramadan. And we're going to go big picture now, because the UNHCR, or the UN Refugee Agency, says a record $46 million was raised through Islamic philanthropy during 2023. Now, that is almost 20% more than in 2022. This Zakat giving helped to support nearly 2 million refugees and internally displaced people across 23 countries, mostly, though, in Lebanon, Yemen and Syria. Now, they say that nearly 50% of refugees actually come from countries in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And that is one of the reasons why the UNHCR is obviously encouraging Muslims to contribute to their refugee Zakat fund. Now, when that sort of news came out, it really got me thinking about Islamic philanthropy, on a grand scale, because there's a huge amount of wealth in the Middle East. And I know that in the past, I'd spoken to an expert, Tawfiq Rahim, who has actually joined me in the studio now. And I've been really interested about the various different trends that come out of the Middle East when it comes to giving. Now, Tawfiq, the first time I spoke to you, mm-hmm, was back in 2018, And unbelievably, 6 years have now passed. So I'm really interested to get a perspective on how things have changed. Just to introduce Tawfiq properly, he's a research fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government, also executive director of GlobeSight, which is a social impact consultancy based here in Dubai. So Tawfiq, how do people choose to give in the UAE? You know, what are the priorities here in the UAE for giving?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. I think the priorities for giving in Ramadan kind of are twofold. So, you know, one, people have their attention kind of just on their local environment. And, you know, Ramadan is a lot about the spirit of giving as much as it is about, you know, where and how you're giving. So there's this idea of kind of coming together, kind of participating in, you know, communal events, communal giving. And so you'll see a lot of people hosting iftars or working with some of the kind of local members who might be from countries where they're separated from their families, etc. And so you'll see a lot of that in the UAE. And then, of course, you have a lot of the campaigns that are both driven by smaller organizations, but also larger ones like UNHCR, where people are looking to give abroad to some of the more challenging kind of situations and humanitarian crises that are unfolding all around us.
And then there's this third element, which I always find the most interesting in some ways, which is your big givers, your very, very wealthy benefactors, and how they are maybe more strategically giving money. Have you noticed any themes in that strategic giving? And has it become more strategic over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you go back to 2011, 12, 13, it was even more difficult to set up a charitable institution here in the UAE. It was very challenging for international organizations to kind of work out of here. And they were not just looking at the UAE, but the Gulf and seeing this very, as you rightly point out, wealthy area that seemingly was off the so-called giving map. And there was this push to say, how do we actually, you know, work in this environment? How do we encourage more giving? And then, of course, the Syrian war was unfolding and the most significant refugee crisis of our times, right? And if you remember back to 2013, 14, 15, you had this entire flow of refugees going into Europe. It was really, you know, unprecedented. And that's when organizations like UNHCR, UNICEF, and others started coming into the region. And one of the things that they thought about was zakat. There was a number that was bandied about that there's $1 trillion of zakat annually that is happening around the world. Where is it going, right? And if you think about it, zakat is 2.5% of wealth that needs to be donated each year. Not
that's
income.
The principle.
That's the principle.
Okay.
So that would mean that, you know, if you aren't making any return on your money over, you know, a period of 40 years, you essentially would run out of your wealth. So the idea is not that it's on your income, it's on your actual kind of wealth that's static. Then you have something called sadaqah, which is a much more voluntary, let's say, charity that you'd also be doing. So zakat is obligatory. It's not optional to give the 2.5%. Now, nobody's untackled what that means in modern times, the taxes as well as zakat, but that's actually the principle. So if you then come back to this region where you're talking about significant share of high net worth individuals, right? So not just the everyday person, but somebody who's, let's say, worth $1 billion or $5 billion or $10 billion. So somebody who's worth $10 billion should be giving $250 million a year in giving. So that was the opportunity that was seen. And over the last decade, a lot of these institutions have formalized kind of their presence in the country, have formalized ways to give, both on the major gifts, but then also on the online giving, which is where a lot of kind of the zakat comes. And what people do is they go and they just click, this is zakat. Now, somebody will need to do an audit to go on the back end to say, is this meeting all the principles of zakat? Because now it's quite a significant number of people donating through these portals.
Okay, so how about these ultra high net worth individuals? Rather than, I don't imagine they're clicking on a website to give zakat in that way. Have you seen a number of those now set up their own institutions or giving foundations?
I think, you know, a lot of the zakat is still happening informally.
Oh, really?
And I think, you know, if you looked at the traditional kind of forms of it here, you would see some of the trading families, well-known names here, in the 80s or 70s, and they'd go to Uganda or they'd go to Kenya or they'd go to Pakistan and they'd fund a mosque or a school. And those still exist. So if you actually go to a lot of these places, you'll see schools and mosques and clinics named after people from, let's say, the UAE and other Gulf countries. A few have set up their foundations. I would say the ones that set up foundations today, if we really analyze it and step back, because we're at the end of a cycle of, let's say, this push and probably the beginning of a new one, I would say the ones that have set up the foundations aren't necessarily the ones that are giving the most.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's still informal then?
I think it's informal and they're just doing direct giving.
Yeah.
You know, somebody will approach them, etc. I think the ones that have set up a full foundation, they're probably more interested or being subsumed in what has been kind of the conversation in the kind of infrastructure of philanthropy, right? And so if you want to participate in the Davos conversation or you want to participate in the United Nations events or you're participating in COP28, you know, there's this whole infrastructure. And how do you play in that infrastructure? Well, you need kind of an institution and you have a foundation and you're part of that lingua franca. But I think that might have reached its zenith, you know, here. I don't see a big groundswell of people looking to set up a foundation. However, I do see people thinking about what is my vehicle for giving, or what is my legacy, or how do I make sure that I have a pathway to kind of contribute? So the question is still there, but the institutionalization is a little bit different.
Such an interesting conversation, and one that I hope that we get to have another time soon. 8 minutes is never enough. So it's such an interesting field. Tofiq Rahim, thank you so much for coming into the Agenda studio. Thank you for your time. As I mentioned, Tofiq is research fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government, or one of their research fellows. He's also executive director of GlobeSight, who are a social impact consultancy based right here in Dubai. Thank you for your time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back to The Agenda. Now, a massive solar flare has hit the Earth over the last few hours after a massive amount of charged particles suddenly erupted from the sun. Now, it's a powerful geomagnetic storm, and apparently it had the potential to disrupt communications on Earth and in space. Now, these types of eruptions are watched by the US-based Space Weather Prediction Center. They said that it was an X-rated flare and that it was en route to Earth. Joining us now to explain why we need to worry about solar flares is engineer Yusuf Farouk, who is from the CubeSat lab at Sharjah Academy of Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology. Yusuf, thank you so much for joining us on the line. Has this geomagnetic storm had any impact on Earth so far?
Hello, Georgia. So it's a pleasure to be back on the show and talking about anything astronomy, astrophysics related. So first of all, how I would like to classify it is this is not the strongest solar storm that we've ever had here on planet Earth. This is I understand the media buzz behind it. I'm that makes me happy to know that the community is generally aware of space weather and its impacts here on Earth. So in terms of its effects to us, it is an intangible effect. It is not something that we humans can feel. However, it can disrupt communication, most likely in the HF region, so in the radio spectrum. So radio communication might be delayed. You might get experiences in like white noise, especially in like aviation, maritime radio. Delays in global navigation system, the GPS that you're using to get to work, for example, might throw off a little bit of errors. But other than that, it's not going to affect us that much, at least with this scale of a storm. There are some more severe solar storms that can happen where we as humans can experience power outages on a grander scale.
So
but luckily that did not happen.
Well, luckily it didn't happen. My understanding is that the sun is at a particularly active period and that we could see bigger geomagnetic storms. Should we be worried about those?
Yes. So the sun goes through something that we call a solar cycle, which is 11 years. So it starts off as a small peak, as in like, so what happens is, to explain why these happen, when the sun blows up, the sun is just this big hydrogen explosion ball. When it blows up, it gives us light, it gives us heat, and it gives us radiation. So those solar storms are happening because of the radiation that is emitted when the sun blows up, or, you know, when those explosions happen. So the sun goes through a cycle. It's 11-year cycle. It starts off as slow. It's like it blows up. It, you know, those explosions happen at a minor scale at, let's say, year one. They peak out at year six, which is around that, you know, where we're at. We're expecting to see an increase in that peak around 2025, 2026. And then it starts going at that other 6 years, starting to cool down again. So 2025, 2026, we might be expecting a more frequent solar storms. However, due to the intensity, we can't predict that now. However, there are some measures to predict geomagnetic storms. You mentioned NOAA. But let's talk about something that we have locally. So here at the Sharjah Academy for Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology, we have been monitoring and studying space weather for the past, since 2017, honestly. We have a dedicated lab to monitor and to understand space weather and its effects to us, its effects on GPS navigation. We also have our own space weather satellite, which is, think of it like a weather station that is up there in space. We call space weather, by the way. Space weather is that radiation. We study the effects of radiation. That's what we call space weather. So we have space weather satellites up in space, like ChargerSat-1, which was launched last year. It has a specific instrument for space weather. ChargerSat-3, however, which will be launched in 2026, has a more sophisticated early warning system, which helps us prevent this communication losses due to geomagnetic storms.
That is very reassuring. I hadn't realized that we had local satellites keeping an eye on the sun and that would potentially keep us safer. Yusuf Farouk, thank you so much for your time. I'd love to get you back on the radio because there's a huge number of questions I'd still like to ask you. Haven't got time now. We've got to go to the news. But that is Yusuf Farouk, who's an engineer at the CubeSat Lab at Sharjah Academy of Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Excuse me, Georgia here. And I'm delighted to say that for the next 10 minutes, we're going to have a really lovely, heartwarming story because doctors at Aster Hospital in Mankul in Dubai are celebrating a success story after they managed to rebuild a young man's face. He's 37. He's called Mohammed Kayor, and his face was left completely unrecognizable after a severe motorbike accident that was not his fault. Now, he was an employee at Aster Pharmacy. He was driving a motorbike in full protective gear when he was struck from behind by a four-wheel drive vehicle in Sharjah. And he was left really badly injured with what's known as panfacial fractures. There was a deep laceration in his thigh. But now, thanks to the care of the team at Aster, his recovery is well underway. Now, a little earlier, producer Milani managed to catch up with Mohammed briefly on the phone.
Accident is Abu Sagara. That time I'm on delivery going Sharjah. Backside coming one car after touch a motorcycle. And after going to Al Qasim, 1 week there, I'm admit. After coming to Mankul Hospital, surgery give Dr. Ranju, very nice doctor. Now if I'm better, 75% is I'm better.
75% he is better. Really lovely to manage to get Mohammed's voice on the radio. He doesn't have fluent English, but he was really keen to thank his doctor and to make sure that message got across. And that doctor is Dr. Ranju Prem, as you just heard. He is a specialist in oral and maxillofacial surgery. So complicated, I can't even say the word. And he works at Aster Hospital in Mankul. And he joins me now on the line. Dr. Ranju, it must have been lovely to hear Mohammed's voice there.
Yes, hi. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Yeah, amazing work. Yeah,
it was nice to hear Tausif talking to me, as always.
Absolutely. Well, tell me a little bit more about this case, because it was incredibly difficult, wasn't it?
Yes, it was incredibly difficult for the very simple fact that Mr. Tausif, the kind of injury which he sustained. So what exactly happened was he got his entire face smashed in the accident, where all the bones of his upper jaw, the lower jaw, including the eye bone, everything was fractured, which happens quite rarely in motor vehicle accidents. Grateful to God that he did not sustain any head injuries, because that happens to be the most important determination of the post-operative success of the patient. We were all really thankful that he had sustained only the facial part of the injuries, which was really complicated, because the moment we took him for the surgery and we opened him up, we could hardly find any piece of bone which we could put it back in place and give him the face the way he was before the accident. But here we are today, and he's also fine. He's recovered almost 80 to 90% of the journey along with us. A little more to go. I'm sure he will recover completely in the next 3 to 6 months from here on.
How many surgeries did he actually have to undergo?
He went for the, as far as the maxillofacial part was concerned, he went underwent a really long surgery, which took us nearly 12 to 14 hours to get his face back. And he had an associated lower limb, the left thigh injury, which was quite deep enough. And that was done subsequently after that.
So you managed to do it all in one massive marathon operation.
Yes,
How do you keep your concentration over 12 hours? That's extraordinary.
I guess I have been doing this in the last 12 years, right from my training days. It naturally comes in, you know.
It's just good practice. And I suppose going forward, then you're expecting Mohamed Tausif Kayor to make a full recovery. He'll have full mobility of his face. And will he? Did you have to use photographs to find out what he looked like before, for example?
Yes, we did. We did ask him about his pre-accidental photos, though he had given us a couple of photos also.
And I suppose, do you have those when you're doing the surgery? Do you have those to one side in your mind?
It is there at the back of our mind always, because we don't keep it at the front of our mind to make it look absolutely the way it is before, because that is where we would end up going a little here and there.
Yeah.
So the first and the most important job is to get the bones intact, get the bones in one piece. Once the bones are set, the framework of the face is reestablished, I'm sure he will get the way he is before the accident.
And so do the bones themselves fuse to each other, or have you had to put metal in his face as well?
Oh, yes. We have put a ton of metals on his face to get him back to the way he is today, because every part of the bone on his facial skeleton was fractured. So we had to go like a jigsaw puzzle to really get it back, like a jigsaw puzzle, one by one. And that took us really somewhere around 12 to 14 hours to finish the surgery.
So absolutely extraordinary work, and really wonderful to have such a sort of a success story. I find they're very important. Too often we just do quite sort of sad news on the radio. So it's really lovely to have that perfect success story. And my goodness me, my understanding from my producer Milani is that Mohamed Tausif Kayor is currently in India. And if he's got a huge amount of metal in his face, I can only imagine that when he comes back through, you know, the detectors, I mean, how on earth is he going to explain that most of his face is metal, and that's why he's making the metal detectors buzz.
Yeah. The detectors are going to beep in, but that's okay. It's a part of the surgery.
It is. That's okay. That's okay, as long as he's alive and he's got his face back. Absolutely amazing work. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Renju Prem, for your time. Fantastic to have you join us on the agenda. As you just heard there, Dr. Renju is a specialist oral and maxillofacial surgeon at Aster Hospital in Mankul in Dubai. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.